Hello, I'm Kate Jabot. Welcome to an extra edition of the BFBS SITREP podcast. Is the tank central to our land warfare capability, or is it destined for the scrap heap of history? This is not a new question. It was being asked more than a century ago as the very first of these armed steel boxers rolled onto the battlefields of France at walking pace in the First World War. Despite a very troubled start, hard tactical lessons and rapid hardware development turned the tank's fate around, making it a military must-have which shaped the world's future and continues to do so. Hamish de Bretton Gordon's new book is part history of the tank and part love letter to the military vehicles which he commanded across more than two decades of service. Written in collaboration with the Tank Museum at Bovington, Tank Command shares the stories of many who've lived and worked on these vehicles, including Hamish himself in the First Gulf War. He also gives his hands-on assessments of tanks from the Cold War to the 21st century and explains how the first tanks were sent for battle before they were ready.
When we were in the First World War in trench warfare, not really making any progress, lots of the great thinkers and strategists at the time trying to work out how we could break this stalemate. And the idea for some sort of armoured vehicle that could break through the trenches was really conceived. And the basis of tanks, firepower, protection and mobility, the sort of holy trinity, as we call it, was really the basis for it all. And it began, you know, with as a lot of innovation in war. We're seeing it in Ukraine at the moment. The pace of innovation when you're at war, you know, just is exponentially faster than it is when you're at peace. And this was, you know, in the First World War, how do you break this trench warfare? How do you actually progress towards the enemy without being decimated? And yeah, everybody or most people will know about the devastation of places like Passchendaele and Verdun, where tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people were mown down. So the ability to have some sort of armored chariot, if it were, that could deliver you onto the enemy lines was the real conception of the very first tanks. And bizarrely, it was actually the Royal Navy, the Admiralty, who led the way, sort of land ships and all the rest of it. And Winston Churchill, who was in charge of the Admiralty at the time, he was very keen. I mean, there were a lot of detractors. The British Army at the time was quite heavily sort of commanded and run by the cavalry. You know, a lot of the cavalry officers, you know, thought that this was some crude and dreadful type of warfare, and there was still a position for a well-bred horse on the battlefield sort of thing. But it was really the demands of warfare, which is how the tank evolved and started to make progress. But everything that we sort of learnt in the First World War, we're sort of relearning again in Ukraine about, you know, how you support tanks, how you operate them, how they run them. But, you know, a long answer to your question, it was there to overcome the very serious problem of entrenched warfare, which bizarrely is almost exactly what we're seeing in Ukraine at the moment, 110 years plus on. So that's its conception, or that was the initial idea.
And you describe how each of the two tracks needed one man to control its speed independently so that the thing could turn. It sounds crazy to imagine.
Absolutely. And if anybody's been to the Tank Museum, and the book is written in collaboration with the Tank Museum, which is the most incredible, I mean, the largest and most comprehensive museum for tanks in the world, and a huge archive as well. And they did a lot of the research. And there are Mark IV tanks in the Tank Museum, and you actually go inside and see it, you know, crew of eight or so. But as you say, incredibly difficult, incredibly laborious, where you've got a tracksman, you know, controlling each track, and you've got the commander in there because of the noise and everything else, sort of tapping people on the shoulder. These things only rumbled along at about 2 to 3 miles an hour, four downhill, flat out, as it were. Incredibly noisy, incredibly unpleasant to be in. You know, we worry about sort of carbon monoxide poisoning and all that sort of stuff now. I mean, in those days, it was, you know, the engine was just belching out stuff in there. But very complex and very slow. And you had the two tanks, the male tank and the female tank. The male tank had sponsons. These are things on the side of the tank with 6-pounder guns, pretty, you know, really big guns for the time. And the female tanks had machine guns. And the idea, you know, one was sort of directly supporting the infantry and the other was taking out pillboxes and other hardened sites. But very, very basic, very difficult to operate in. Mm. And that's why I think we think, you know, the first people who operated these tanks, you know, the crew really set the pace. And it was my own regiment, the Royal Tank Regiment that grew out of the Royal Tank Corps that sort of started it, but very basic machines.
And you describe that when you talk about having male and female tanks, it sounds extraordinary. How did that idea actually come about?
Well, how the designation between male and female came about, I'm not entirely sure. And one has to always tread terribly
carefully,
days when we're going to this. But, you know, it was the Royal Tank Regiment, of course, who developed the tanks and led it. It was the Royal Tank Regiment who first had female tank crews and tank commanders in the British Army. And now it is, you know, there is no differentiation. In fact, My own son, who's now a cavalry officer, on his tank commander's course at the moment, that it, you know, is virtually parity. So going back to why they are designated that, I don't know the reason for the nomenclature, but the idea that you have a tank with heavy machine guns on it that can support infantry, and of course the infantry are using the tank to protect themselves as well, and then you've got the male tanks with the bigger six pounder guns for knocking holes in pillboxes and other sort of solid positions.
And these things all revolutionized land warfare, but you mentioned already naval engineers were central to the development.
Exactly, and that is, you know, again, that's a strange quirk of history, but actually those are people who know anything about the British military, you know, it's not unsurprising. And I expect with Churchill heading the Admiralty at the time, you know, he was ostensibly a soldier. He was a cavalry officer, fought in the Boer War. And, you know, dare I say it, probably knew more about land operations than perhaps maritime operations. And developed it forward, and it was the Navy that had the wherewithal and the ideas to go forward. And very quickly, it sort of molded into what we now call joint operations. That was perhaps the precursor for the idea that actually, you know, the Army, Navy, and the Air Force must work very closely together to get best effect. But the fact that the Navy, you know, developed the first tanks is a wonderfully a wonderful illustration of the British military.
And yet then, when they got the hardware, better at least, that's only part of it. Knowing how to use it to best effect had to be learned in action.
Well, that's right. Absolutely. There were a lot of troubles to begin with. And there were a lot of people, you know, in the Imperial General Staff, as I mentioned earlier, who were not necessarily keen on these sort of iron beasts. And we're not giving it, you know, the full sort of support. Now, General Haig was keen on the tanks, and you had people like Churchill and others, and then some other sort of key figures as well. But it was how you use them, and how you use them in the First World War is exactly sort of how we use them today, and what we're seeing in Ukraine. You know, a tank on its own is pretty vulnerable. Therefore, it's got to be operated with the support of others, the infantry, the artillery, the air, to cover it to get best effect. And also, it's about mass. And there's a lot throughout the book about the balance between mass and technology. And in the early days, when the tanks were first used in the First World War, they didn't, you know, they were used in ones and twosies, or, you know, not enough to have an impact. So it was Combray that was in November 1917, which was really the first time they got massed together, hundreds of tanks, hundreds of Mark IVs, to get together to create, you know, what we call shock action. That is the ability of armor to have an effect. But it is not just tanks. It's got to be supported by the artillery and the infantry as well. And the coordination and control of that, again, is we have the same issues today, and it's about training. And one of the issues when you're in contact at war, the ability to train is really difficult. And one of the reasons that the Russians are faring so badly in Ukraine at the moment, they can't train their people. They don't have the time. They just throw them in. And an untrained person is a lot less effective than a trained one. So before Cambrai, as much as possible was done to train the tanks in combined arms operation with all the other arms to have an impact. But yeah, I sort of say the Mark IVs were pretty unreliable. Again, a theme throughout my book is about the reliability of these beasts. Mm-hmm. And that was another challenge. But they were brand new. They were only sort of a year or two old in the Battle of Cambrai in 1970. People were getting to use them. When recruiting for the tank corps, they went out, you know, people who had ridden motorcycles or knew how to look after engines. Those are the initial recruits because, you know, these things needed an awful lot of maintenance. And it's exactly the same as we see today. If, mm-hmm. you know, we're seeing it with the Ajax vehicle at the moment, you know, lots of issues with it. But one of the basic premises, you've got to look after it. You've got to maintain it. You've got to do all the servicing. Exactly the same back in the First World War with the Mark IV. If, you know, if the oil wasn't topped up and the tracks weren't tightened, the ruddy things broke down. So,
yes.
Yeah.
To that point, when the very first tanks went into battle, it didn't go well. Indeed, a significant number didn't even make it to the first battle.
Entirely, absolutely. There was so much secrecy behind the use of tanks because it was seen as this, you know, potentially game-changing, battle-winning capability, which is one reason why it's called a tank. You know, the idea was a tank could have covered a multitude of sins, and you know, how could you have this tracked wheeled armored vehicle with a big gun being called a tank? But so the operational security was absolutely key, but because they were so unreliable that the number that crossed the start line was you know, not the whole lot, and the number that broke down again was significant, and it was only at Cambrai where they massed tanks together where they had such a great impact on the first 24 hours. But then, as we sort of learned, because our training and all everything else to do with it, our modus operandi, because they ran out of support from their infantry, everybody else, they quickly lost a lot of ground. But the premise was there. If you do combined arms operation correctly, tanks can be the battle winner, as we see across history on various battles.
So just how close did the tank experiment, if I can call it that, how close did it come to being abandoned?
Very close indeed. Absolutely. There are a number of people who thought we should concentrate on other things. And Cambrai, that's why people in the tank regiment and the Royal Armoured Corps, you know, Cambrai is such an important thing because that was, in effect, the tank corps was said, here you go, here's Cambrai. Prove its capability, or pretty much that is it. And Cambrai initially was a fantastic success, and its ultimate, the fact that we didn't reinforce that success is not a failure of the tank as such, more a failure of command and control. So yeah, very, very close indeed, as it has throughout its history. But my sort of final word in the book is, you know, I am sure in 100 years' time, somebody like me will be talking about something called a tank that has firepower, protection, and mobility. And if history is anything to go by, I'm pretty confident in that assertion.
And if we do come forward then, Hamish, your first tank, the Chieftain, you say was in some ways not that different from the Mark IV of World War I. What was it like?
Well, it was very unreliable. I suppose that's why I suggest that it is so similar. I mean, the Chieftain had a bus engine, a Leyland bus engine, and it was supposed to be, you know, that people were trying to make it more than it was. That the reason it was multi-fueled, it could take any sort of fuel, but the technology wasn't there to sort of make it work, as it were. And they would, it was just incredibly unreliable, and it was. But it was pretty basic, a bit like the sort of Mark IV engine. I remember, you know, I was a maintenance officer, so I was trained in the sort of engines, the tanks, as actually we all were. And I can remember there's some very basic things. You know, if the tank, a lot of the reason the engine didn't start, it was something to do with the fuel injection system. But you could get a bit of rope and tie open the fuel injection pump. And the thing would start, you know, a bit of rope and wire tied around the back deck.
Incredible.
And it was real Heath Robinson and very, very slow as well. So I think that that's why. And inside, you know, pretty basic. I've just test driven the Challenger 3, which is, you know, the sort of third iteration development. And, you know, the difference in inside is amazing. I mean, we used to get in contortions trying to fire the gun because you had to sort of turn right to your side to fiddle about with your fire control panel, at the same time looking through your sight, at the same time pressing the firing button. And, you know, it was a miracle if you hit anything. So that's why. But, you know, Chieftain was... It was a, you know, had a decent engine, everything else. For its time, it was fine. And, you know, certainly all the rest of the British tanks up to Challenger 3 are a development of it. But, yeah, the unreliability was desperate.
And no wonder, Hamish, that you got close to your fellow tankies, because living and working in the same place in those conditions must have been quite challenging.
It was. I mean, it was very interesting, you know, having, you know, going straight out of Sandhurst, and then into that world. I mean, I, in military terms, I'm sort of termed as a Surrey Highlander, sort of somebody with Scottish background who's never really been to Scotland. And I joined the Scottish Regiment, and who recruited from Glasgow, and a sort of, you know, a sort of posh boy from the south bumping into all these Glaswegians, who then you live intimately in a tank with. And in those days, we did an awful lot of training, especially going up to the Gulf War. And, you know, we'd spend months and months on your tank. And, you know, it is, you know, there are no secrets and all very close. And it's sort of, you know, some of those people in my tank crew and the people I met there, you know, these very tough Glaswegians are now some of my greatest friends. I've known them for, you know, 30, 40 years or so. But you get, it's, I think, you know, from when you come from such different backgrounds and all the rest of it, but you meld together. And, you know, us all human beings, we can all get on and do, but it was a bit of a shock initially. And also it's very claustrophobic, being sort of shut down in these things for a while. And a lot of the time, you know, certainly when you're young and before you become experienced, you know, knowing where you know, I think for the first year driving around in my tank, I rarely knew where I actually was. You just follow on and hope for the best. But then you do get used to it. But it's a funny environment to live in, and absolutely doesn't suit everybody. But again, one of the things I say in the book, you know, in my 25 years as a tank commander, I was never too hot, never too cold, never too uncomfortable. And you know, I thought it was a great vehicle to sort of live on and ultimately operate in.
I found that really hard to believe when I read that, Hamish. Really? You never too hot, never too cold, never too uncomfortable?
Not really. I mean, I might be remembering through rose-coloured spectacles. I do remember a time in Battis in Canada, the training area, when actually pre-Second Gulf War, we were doing a three-month exercise, and I was the second in command of the 2nd Royal Tank Regiment in my Challenger 2. And one particular day, I think it was fairly late in the year, probably October time, and it was very cold. It was snowing, and we were actually parked up in a Liga for the day, and we were listening on the radio to the infantry attacking Mount Igman that people have been to Canada will know well, and it was horrific, and people were going down with cold injuries. But I got a real telling off from the brigade headquarters, because the G4 staff, the logistics staff, said, you know, Hamish, how come two RTR have just used 50,000 litres of diesel today and you haven't moved anywhere? And I had to make up some cock and bull story that, oh, we were testing the engines. In truth, all the tanks had their engines running. And we had our tank sheets over the back decks, and we were sitting there literally in T-shirts and flip-flops as the infantry were freezing in the snow in Mount Igman. But yeah, that's a sort of extreme. But yeah, no, I would stand by that, and I'm sure a lot of people would say. Having said that, of course, I say I'm painting a colourful picture, but it's also pretty painful too. You know, most tankies have, you know, bits and pieces missing. You know, we call it the turret monster, which the turret monster not only eats anything that you drop, but also, you know, any casual finger that's left in the wrong place happens to go and and you'll see it. I have all my fingers and thumbs, but I know an awful lot of my chums don't.
Okay, that was going to be my next question, but I don't need to ask that now. Tell me about your first experience of going to war, though, in a tank. And how did the reality compare to your training?
Well, it was very interesting. It was the first Gulf War. I had just done another BATIS in Canada as a troop leader on Chieftain. And I had to come back to the UK early. So I was one of the first few back at Osnabrück in the 4th Royal Tank Regiment, was my regiment where we were based. And I remember going to the adjutant's desk, and there was a signal, which is an old format of a typed note on the desk saying that the 1420th King's Hussars in Munster need two officers. So in typical fashion, I picked up the signal. There was one other officer, a Zimbabwean, John Moore, mate of mine. And I said, look, you know, 1420th needs some officers. So literally we went to the armory, signed out some guns, jumped in our car, went to Munster and signed on. And I became the liaison officer for B Squadron 1420th Hussars. And they're on Challenger 1. I was actually in a Ferret, which is a sort of armored reconnaissance vehicle. So my first contact was actually in a little armored vehicle. And then, you know, all the training I'd done in Canada, I was actually much better trained probably than a lot of the guys in the 1420th Hussars. And when we got to Saudi Arabia, I was sort of helping organizing all the training and everything else. But my role in my little in my armored car was to charge around with the squadron, getting orders from all over the place, and in the battles themselves, sort of being around to help out. So my first experience was actually in an armored car, a sort of mini tank, if you like. And you know, it was amazing. I mean, there were so many stories that came out of the first Gulf War. I mean, my first abiding memory, much to the chagrin of my driver, Corporal Boo Boo Johnson, another very, very, very a great man, another tough Glaswegian. I remember the first night of the war when there was an awful lot of firing going on. I kept getting to move all the time because I understand now from others it's common experience that you sort of think every bullet, every missile is heading your direction, mm-hmm. but of course it's not. So that was it. And then I tell a story about that. I had two blue on blues in the Gulf War, which I think are worth unpacking. I can't remember the sequence, but the first one directly involved me, and I'm very happy to tell it because I know the person who was responsible.
Go ahead.
Well aware, our forward observation gunnery officer, a great mate of mine called Derek Hudson, about 15 years after the Gulf War, came up to me at a cocktail party and said, "Have you ever forgiven me, Hamish, for almost killing you in the Gulf War?" And I was silent for probably only a few seconds. Now it seems longer. And then I remembered. I said, "Yeah, bloody hell, I've forgotten about that." And he basically fired about 15 to 30 rounds of his machine gun, his Kirk's machine gun, at my ferret, thinking I was an enemy vehicle. And apparently on the net, I was getting, you know, effing and blinding, telling him to stop. But very luckily, neither me or my driver were hit, but all our kit was completely trashed, sleeping bags and everything else. So that was one thing. But actually, The most significant one, which I only learned about quite recently, was very major indeed. There were a number of blue on blues. This is friendly fire incidents in the first Gulf War, because actually in the confusion of battle, and most of the operations in the first Gulf War were done at night, because that's where we thought we had the advantage over the Iraqis, because our night vision systems were better. But actually identifying what the targets were is really difficult. A real challenge. And I think it was either the second evening where the Household Cavalry Squadron who were part of the 1420th but attached to another battle group. 14 Challenger 1s commanded by James Hewitt of infamy or fame,
yes.
who is a very dear friend of mine. He identified these targets to the front and requested permission to fire. You asked for IFF, identify friend or foe. And it came back from his battle group headquarters, there were no friendly forces out fire, front, you cleared a fire. He was uncertain about this. So he said, no, I'm not happy. Please, can you go to the higher command, the brigade command, who have better surveillance devices, and confirm that these are not friendly? Apparently, it came back from the brigade, no, there are no friendlies out there, fire. And James Hewitt kept saying, no, I'm not happy, I'm not going to do it. And apparently, you know, he was telling me that actually people were getting pretty cross with him and saying, no, get on with it, fire. And he didn't. And then he was just about to issue a fire order, and over his neck came, stop, no, those are friendly forces. And it was us, it was 1420th, B Squadron, 1420th King's Hussars, that at 1500 meters, had they opened up, we probably wouldn't have been here. And I did another podcast with James a few months ago and others, and I said to James, you know, you might have made a few poor decisions in your life, and he's the first person to admit that, but the one really, really important decision, you got absolutely right. Mm-hmm. And us members of B Squadron 1420th Hussars, every 28th of February, which is when we celebrate the Battle of Al Hanya, we raise a glass to you, because we might not have been here had you not had the moral courage to back up your thoughts.
And you also, I mean, that's an incredible story, and quite interesting that you only recently kind of found out that you might have been obliterated long ago and that you weren't. It's quite incredible to find those things, I'm sure, after the event that never happened, as it were.
It is, absolutely. And it only came to light. I think there might be reasons that it was suppressed that are not worth going into.
Fair
here.
Enough.
But General Richard Sheriff, who was our squadron leader, who went on to be deputy commander of NATO, D. Sacur, he wrote to the Guards magazine, I think about 18 months ago, to say, you know, now this story is out, you know, a formal thanks from B Squadron 1420th Hussars to the Household Cavalry and to James here. So, brilliant. And I've known James a long time, and, you know, he hasn't had a great time. And I think, you know, when credit is due, it should be well and truly sort of stapled up there.
Yeah, good of you to say so. And you also write about the build-up in the book to the Second Gulf War and how you and a small band of tanks wreaked havoc in battlefield training through bold action and not playing by the rules. What happened there?
Well, yeah, that I think that's a really interesting thing. You know, the Russians call it maskirovka, you know, deception, you know, not playing by the rules. And it is... I think sometimes in our training, you know, we very much want to stick by the rules. And I remember a particular squadron leader in the Royal Tank Regiment, who I won't mention, who was he was a great stickler for the rules, and you had to follow it and all the rest of it. But in Battus, when we had this sort of it's called TES, tactical engagement system. So your tank was wired up with lasers, so you weren't actually firing real bullets, but you're firing lasers, and it operated the same. And but you know, there were certain rules, but I was the second in command of 2RTR, and you know, I used to get a little bit bored hanging around at the back. So, you know, on a number of occasions, I'd decide to go off on a sort of tank hunt, and we were tremendously successful. But the rule book says, and I'm sort of slightly contradicting what I said in the First World War, this whole thing about mutual support, you need tanks supporting each other and all the rest of it, but actually we just went off on our own tank hunting and wreaked havoc. This was training, but there are so many other examples in warfare where people have really taken the initiative, taken the risk, And even, you know, we're seeing individual tank actions in Ukraine, which are having a real difference. So there is a time to follow the rules, and there is a time to ignore them and get on and do stuff. So that, to me, again, it's you know, warfare and everything else, the Maskarovka, the, you know, deception, getting inside people's thoughts, doing what people don't expect. That has always been successful on the battlefield. But sometimes it's difficult to explain it and justify it in the cold light of a non-warfare environment, as it were.
And you worked with the Tank Museum, as you said, at Bovington to write this book. In that process, did you actually learn anything that surprised you?
Well, yeah. I mean, so many things. And I think just despite the fact having been a tank officer for, you know, nearly a quarter of a century, and, you know, having, you know, on my troop leaders course out of Sandhurst, you know, we spent a lot of time in the Tank Museum looking at things and all the rest of it. But some of the knowledge, particularly some of the academics at the Tank Museum, is their understanding and knowledge is just phenomenal, and you know, their breadth of knowledge too. So I think, you know, it is every day is a school day at the Tank Museum. You sort of learn new things all of the time. Although I suppose the overarching thing I've sort of learned, and what I suppose the strap line for the book is, you know, the tank is dead, long live the tank. And its basic concept, really from the Battle of Cambrai to now, is undiminished. I mean, I also write in the book about, you know, the Battle of Cambrai, they had the real issues with Germans throwing sticky bombs like grenades on top of the tank, where the armor was the weakest. Mm-hmm. So they built these sort of chicken wire cages so that the
sounds familiar, bomb, doesn't it?
It's a funny old thing. You look at the tanks in Ukraine at the moment, and in the early days of the war in Ukraine, first person view drones dropping hand grenades through tank hatches were destroying £5 million tanks. So the lesson was put metal cages on. You know, exactly the same as Cambrai. But, you know, 110 years later.
So in concluding the book, you describe the tank as one of the most important capabilities of the battlefield over the last century, but one that must adapt to still have its place in the order of battle. Notwithstanding what you just said, how does it remain relevant in today's warfare?
Well, I think first of all, firepower, mobility and protection, shock action is what you want. That's the capability you want on the battlefield. And in order to do that, you need to be able to maneuver, what we call combined arms maneuver. So maneuver about the battlefield with all the other arms supporting you, and then you can create that shock action. Now, what we saw in the early days of Ukraine is that just couldn't happen, because Ukraine has become a drone-infested battlefield, if you like. And in order for a tank to be relevant on that battlefield, it must be able to operate in it. Now, that is now happening. So in the last 6 months or so, Ukraine has developed the ability to use tanks again in that combined arms maneuver, because they've been able to suppress the drone threat. And they've done that through a number of ways, electronic ways, what we call hard kill defensive aid suites, active protection, where sensors on the tank pick up drones and then fire missiles or fire cartridges and stuff to take the drones down. And also, tanks are now using drones themselves. So, you know, and I know a lot of experimentation is going on in the British Army with Ajax, Recce Strike and Challenger 3, where a drone will have a number of drones at target end to identify targets and adjust fall of shot, but also a number of drones protecting it. So it's, you know, with any threat, it's about identifying it and mitigating it. And for the tank to be relevant in the future, that's what it has to do. But what we're seeing, why tanks are being effective in Ukraine, is not only can they take out other tanks and armored vehicles at 3 kilometers, but the drones are also allowing them to go over the hill, as it were. And, you know, a tank round, if you fire it at the right elevation, can probably go 15 to 20 kilometers. Now, what the other thing we're seeing in Ukraine is smart artillery munitions. So 155mm artillery, which is a standard NATO munition, they've now developed these smart sort of artillery shells that become loiter munitions and smart munitions and that can precision guide themselves. So the next stage, I think, for the tank is to be able to fire smart munitions as well. So the relevance is to stay ahead of the threat and develop. But ostensibly, you know, the Mark IV tank, the Battle of Cambrai, is no different from the Challenger 2s tearing up the battlefield in Ukraine today, and probably Challenger 3 for the next 20 or so years. But we need to keep evolving.
And could you, Hamish, imagine the tank continuing but without people on board, because remote operational autonomy are sweeping through military kit?
Entirely. I think the two other things that struck me is exactly that, autonomous vehicles. And we're already seeing a lot of autonomous vehicles being used. I sort of suggest that actually the Challenger 3, you know, we're used to a troop of tanks being three tanks or four tanks. You know, I think in future, a troop of tanks might be one manned Challenger 3 with a whole bunch of autonomous tanks. And there is experimentation to go that you could have an autonomous tank with a big tank gun or something else on it working alongside it and supporting it. So I think that is going to be. And the other element that I think is electric power. Electric power for the automotive side, the engine side, but also for the gun. People might have heard of things called rail guns, where you can fire a projectile at, you know, unbelievable speeds. But axiomatically, it was the Germans who were experimenting with electric power back in the Second World War for tanks. In fact, Porsche, who bizarrely was one of the German tank manufacturers, at the early stages of the Second World War, he wanted to have electric drives in tanks. But the Germans didn't think it was a very good idea. We wind forward now, and I'm just amazed that we're not, you know, if we can fly aeroplanes on electric power, surely we can drive tanks on it too.
Hamish, you've given us so much to think about. Thank you so much. It's been great talking to you.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
And the book is Tank Command, How the Tank Changed the Face of Battle. Hamish de Breton-Gordon, thank you very much.
Defence Explained. This is SITREP.